Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, writers John Barrett and Taylor Mack discuss the Goodman Theater's world premiere stage musical adaptation of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Barrett is the author of the original book the musical is based on, and Mack wrote the book for the adaptation. The following conversation originally took place July 8th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. I'm Kerry Cranston, president here at the American Writers Museum. I just wanted to say welcome and thank you for coming out this morning. We're very excited by today's program. Today's program was meant to be just a podcast taping. We've never had this many people for a podcast taping, so thanks for coming out. But we're very excited by this, and we're excited for the content we're going to create and put online. So everything you hear today, you'll be able to watch on YouTube and listen to on our podcasts. With that said, we're going to make a quick intro. Today is obviously a conversation about one of the most important books of the last 30 years. On its 30th anniversary edition, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. It was an amazing, groundbreaking book that really changed the way people look at fiction and nonfiction alike. And so we're excited to have with us two very important writers, the writer of the book, John Barrett, and the writer... And now that this book has been converted into a musical, we have the very famous theater artist, Taylor Mack, with us as well. So I want to thank you both for being here. And as I mentioned to both of you, I'm not going to go into long bios. Famous journalist and author, John Barrett, theater artist, Taylor Mack, their bios are too long to read. But with that said, I was very, very excited because I remember when this book came out. It was a huge, amazing book that was very different than anything I'd read. I was a lover, as I was mentioning to you two, of writers of the South. And so even though you are not a writer of the South, you had embodied that voice, I think, in an amazing way. And it really showed, and it brought these amazing, you know, powerful characters to life. One of the things I was thinking about when thinking about interviewing the two of you was when you look at that book and what was different about it, the idea that you took a nonfiction story, a very true story, I think you've said 99% true, or we'll go 98% maybe, but really wrote it like a novel. I kind of feel like, you know, there's a sense that this was a groundbreaking element to what we might call the true crime genre. And I think it's funny that we're recording a podcast right now because the podcast industry in and of itself has really burgeoned on the idea of true crime. In 2014, when Serial came out, it literally changed the idea of why people listen to podcasts. And while there are many podcasts that are not about true crime, obviously it is a huge genre within that. It's a huge genre within nonfiction writing. I'm kind of curious, John, what do you think about true crime as a genre? What do you think about your book, and should it be considered in that element or not?
You know, when I started out, all I had in mind was writing something people would want to read. I didn't think of genres at all. I had been a writer for years. I wrote for Esquire. I had a column at Esquire. I was a staff writer. I was an editor at Esquire. And the editor of Esquire at the time was a man named Harold Hayes. He was terrific. He was an inspiration to me. But one of the things he wanted to do is to establish a voice of Esquire. So there were a lot of pieces that were unsigned. We wrote them. But they were to be the genre Esquire voice, the voice, the tone. And that Harold harped on that a lot. And really, it was part of my education in writing, because I knew what the tone was. It was knowledgeable irreverence. That's what he wanted. Because it was a snappy magazine. And so I kind of got used to writing that way. And then I had a column in Esquire. And I tried out a lot of things. The narrative, the ones I did that had some narrative in them, I liked best. So when I decided that Savannah was going to be my topic, I used all of the arts that I'd been told about and learned along the way, narrative being one of them, because a lot of things in Esquire were not narrative, they were explanatory, etc. So I didn't even think of true crime. I did know that murder sells, that I know, and it focuses the mind, and so I started out with that in mind. But what I did was write as if I were still an Esquire editor and writer covering Savannah. I looked for interesting people and situations. Well, but the town was the first thing that attracted me because it was so gorgeous. I mean, I'd never seen anything like it. Many of you probably have been there. It is an astonishingly beautiful city. And it's an enclave. It's a self-sustained universe right there on the Georgia coast. They don't care what goes on outside. That appealed to me. They rarely go to Charleston, which is only an hour and a half away, and they don't go to Atlanta that much either, which is 2 or 3 hours. And the highway between Savannah and Atlanta is called, it's Route 16. It's called the loneliest highway in America because nobody's on it, is what they say. So I loved the fact that this was a universe unto itself. And I noticed right away that people spoke with an ironic sense of humor, all of them. And they another thing is they loved to tell stories, so they weren't just sitting there glumly. They were chatting all the time. I had no problem getting people to talk. And the fact that they knew I was writing a book, I did not spring it on them. I just told them I was writing a book. And if they were a little uneasy at first, they got over it, because I treated every interview I had as a conversation. So I gave as well as they did. And so it became a conversation, and not so threatening to any of the people I spoke to. I had an easy time, I must say, because they loved to talk, and they weren't afraid of me. And so I may have lost the thread, but you wanted to ask me about
that. Well, I think you kind of answered that, you know, I was asking if this was true crime
right.
To some extent, obviously, it's not, because it's really a love song to a city and a town that is very unique unto itself.
Yeah, and I simply picked and chose what I wanted. I really didn't have a concept of how the book would fall out, how it would be arranged. In fact, when I was writing about Jim Williams and the first part of the book, I just was going along, and when he killed Danny Hansford and arrested, that chapter ended, and I turned the page, I actually put no new paper in the machine, and I simply wrote part two. I had no idea that what followed was going to be part two. But in fact, it should have been, and is. But it just came to me. So I didn't really plot out true crime, whatever. I just did what fit and what I thought I could do well. I'm constantly looking for the light version, the light view, the humor, because Savannah is largely humorous and tragic, but my take was that it was my book has a lot of funny things in it, and that's why I enjoyed writing it so much.
I mean, that's a great way to think about what created this, you know, your time at Esquire, that voice, the notion then that the town and the city of Savannah really brings you in, and murder sells, so that is an element to this story, and probably a really great focal point for the story that's much more than a true crime story.
Yeah, and this was the most visible social male in town, had the party of the year every year, and the boy who got shot was, from the other side of the tracks.
Right. And Taylor, I'm kind of curious from your point of view, and so something that's as iconic as this book, as I had read, this was a project that was about 10 years in the making to create this musical. I'm curious when you were brought into the project and what drew you in, what excited you about it?
Well, I was brought in 5 years ago, and I think they wanted to make it a jukebox musical. That didn't quite work out. They decided to start over, and so that the team was assembled new, essentially. And so Jason and I came on board and So nothing that's in our version was in the former version. It's not like we doctored their script or anything like that. We just started fresh. But I think just listening to you talk about it, I think some of these categories are booksellers' ideas. You know that, and it sounds like I'm a hybrid artist, and I think you are too in a lot of ways. And so, I think I understand that people are chasing taste, you know, because that's what sells, is when you click into somebody's taste. But I think my taste is very eclectic. And so I was really drawn to the book because of its eclecticism. And it came out at a certain time in 1994 when I was just coming to New York City, and I didn't know anyone, and I was starting a new life, and it was a companion. So I think I have a special place in my heart for it.
Okay, that's awesome. I'm curious, I didn't get a chance to ask you before, in the process of adapting this for stage, did you two have any interaction? and what was that process like?
I mean, we met early on. We had periodically throughout the 5 years, we had dinner together. John would have me over at his house. We'd have dinner. I'd give him updates. We'd talk about things. He's a great editor. I like to take his notes. I've been thinking about this project as, I don't think I've ever said this to you, but I've been thinking of it as your grandchild, not necessarily your child, but you know, so it's he didn't make it, but he's all over it.
That's very good. Right? That's very good. Yeah. Very good. Yeah.
Well, that's a great thing to note. It's good to know that there is that level of collaboration. You know, you've already talked about Savannah as a character, and I think that was kind of my next point. But I think you've kind of covered it. I mean, you talk about it. When you got there the first time, what was your impression of it, and how did it change over time?
The first impression I had was the look of it. It stunned me. I was absolutely in awe of the beauty of this lovely town and the atmosphere, all aspects of the atmosphere. And people really were interested in meeting other people. And so I hadn't experienced that in New York. In New York, you don't even know who your neighbors are, particularly if you live in an apartment house. In Savannah, everybody knew everybody else. It's one person said to me, we're a very cousin-y people. So watch what you ask one person about somebody else. You could be a cousin. It had a charm. The people had a charm, basically, that they shared. And I noticed it in many of the people I met down there. And it was a light, whimsical sometimes, but ironic. And I sort of, in fact, part of the book is written as if I were a Savannian. The voice, not from the prospect of a Savannian, but the voice and the narrative style telling a story. I felt I was in sync with certain of the characters I had gotten to know very well. So I learned from them a narrative style. As I say, they talk all the time, they tell stories. And sometimes while I was writing, I thought, oh, this sounds like Joe Odom, keep going. That was a character. So that, I would say that's something that I learned but didn't realize it until halfway through.
And I'm curious, then, when we talk about this place, so Taylor, when you're adapting this for the stage, you know, how much of that notion of Savannah is in the story that you're writing as a place, and then how are you communicating that or communicating with the designers? So from your point of view as the writer and adapter of the story, but you're working in a collaborative environment, obviously, on a play. Yeah. So how is your vision of this story's space then contextualized by the designers that you're working with, and what's that relationship like?
Well, we were just talking about this back there, that there's an opening sequence right when we start. You know, the house kind of is slowly going to black. You're starting to see a figure, Minerva, who's a voodoo practitioner, who's on the stage. And then you start to see some ghostly figures coming in. You start to see a little bit of the cemetery. And for me, and for Tanya, our choreographer, and Rob, the director, we all were talking about how we wanted to slow the audience down to Savannah time. So just add a little bit of time before the big, you know, musical comes in. Like just a little time for everyone to say, right, we just got off the street of the loop. We're all excited. We have our expectations about what this is going to be. We've decided what it's going to be before we get there. And we're just saying, just slow down. See if you can come with us and chase the show we made as opposed to that we're trying to chase your taste, you know, and just see if you can slow down to Savannah time. And so, and Savannah has a real, it's just a lot slower. The pace there is so much slower. So can we do that and still find the spirit of the town, as you say, the humor of the town in within that pace? So that's what we did. Yeah. A lot of that kind of, those kind of conversations and figuring out what it is that would invite people into a different environment.
Kind of want to talk through some of the characters in this, and both how they are in the book, who they were, and also then, you know, how that translates to the stage a little bit. And so I'm gonna start with the two central characters of Jim Williams and Danny Hansford. I think it's really interesting when you look at a story like this, and I know I mentioned true crime, and I just, when we talk about something like a murder, you have two characters, one of whom you spoke with at length over years, and one who you never would have met. And so the second one is created by other people's perceptions,
right,
and what you get from them. So I'm kind of curious, you know, how do you take the construction of these characters, one who you knew well and one who you had to pull together from the stories of others?
Well, the one Jim Williams, I talked to hour after hour, and he was absolutely fascinating. He'd already shot Danny by then, by the time I met him. He was extremely knowledgeable about Georgia history, about American history, about antiques, everything. He was a polymath, actually. And he also had a very serious sense of humor. His humor was not as ironic as everybody else's, but it was visual, and it was incredible. So he appealed to me a lot as a character. And he introduced me to people who then became characters. He called his friends and said, "There's this guy, he's writing a book. I don't know what he's going to say. I want my story told, so I'm cooperating with him, and I hope you will too." So that was a great help. That does not always happen when you try to dig out a story in a situation like this. Danny Hansford, I talked to enough people to get a really full profile of him in my mind. I talked to his mother. I talked to people who worked with him in various places, or who knew him, or had fights with him, or whatever. So I really thought I had a pretty good idea who he was. And I couldn't talk to him, of course, but so that was the difference. But I ended up, I think, with two rather full profiles in my mind, both of them.
Yeah. And then, so when you're looking at those characters from the book, you know, recognizing where they come from in those stories, how are you adapting their story onto the stage, and what's different for you?
Well, first off, the main difference is that it's a musical, so it sings, and they don't sing. Right? So you have to say, why do they sing? And you have to say, oh, okay, automatically it's not a representation. It's because if it was representation, nobody would sing, right? Mm-hmm. So you get this freedom, just the permission of you're writing a musical, which means it's people's inner thoughts. It's their heart desire that they wear on their sleeve in front of the audience. It's all of those various things. So that's fun. Also, the book is already there for us. So if we just put the book on the stage, it's kind of, in my mind, it's not serving the purpose of what a musical can do. So, and I think the book is wonderful, so you can go to the book. So I say, well, what can we do on a stage that a book can't do? And one of the things that we have, one of our tools in the theater is that we can show the private moment in a way that John is almost always present in the entire book, because that's the structure. But in the musical, we can show the private moment. So one of the things I did was write a little love scene for Danny and Jim, because I what I discovered is that they had a great deal of love for them, for each other. And the press wasn't necessarily going to say that. And the time that it was written in wasn't necessarily going to celebrate that. And it's complicated because it's a murder. So I just wanted to make space for both Jim and Danny to be in the garden of good and evil, not just evil, or find some room for them. So
that's really interesting to think about, especially a scene that didn't exist in the book and John's presence in the book.
Yeah,
and,
but John also gave me access to, you know, phone conversations, little notes that they wrote each other, things like that. That
oh, wow. So really interesting source material that we had not seen.
Yeah, and I'm a queen, so, you know, and yeah. I'm a queen who's been in a relationship with a man who's 26 years older than me, so I brought a lot of that knowledge to those little scenes. It's not as strange to me as it might be to the reader. Yeah,
that's awesome.
I took a more oblique approach to the love for each other. And I put it all in Minerva's words.
Yeah.
So when they're in the graveyard, and Minerva and the boy is dead, and Minerva's trying to quiet him down so he won't do any harm to Jim, and Jim will be able to lead his life. She said, "Tell me about something about the boy." He said, "Well, he tried to kill me." "No, I know that. Well, tell me something good about him." "I can't think of anything." "And then, well, what did he love? What did he like?" And Jim said, "Oh, his Camaro, his 1971 Camaro. He loved that. He was so good at painting the stripes." And then he talks lovingly about his memory of this boy. And so Minerva says, "I heard him back off a little bit." Jim says, "What do you mean?" He said, "He heard you say you loved him." That's most what I didn't do much more than that to say love between the two of them. Probably should have, but I didn't.
Hmm. That's an interesting way of looking at that. You just brought up Minerva, who is a character I next wanted to get to, based on Valerie Bowles, an actual person that you had interactions with. And so I wanted to ask you first about the significance of her to the story, and why her character was so important to you, and what you found interesting about Minerva, voodoo in general, and its prevalence in the community.
It started with a phone conversation from Jim to me. He said, "What are you doing tomorrow night?" I'm going to meet an important person, and if you're free, you can come along. And he was going to see Minerva to get her to put a hex on the district attorney. I had no idea what was going to happen. So I hadn't gone into this thinking I'm going to look for voodoo priestesses, but I was thrilled to have the door opened to a whole new vision, a whole new character. And Jim, now this is what was so clever about Jim. He knew that I would respond that way.
Yeah.
He said, "I'm going to show him something really terrific for what I, as a writer, wanted to write about."
Yeah.
So he really gave me wonderful character, and I did not go into it knowing that I was going to do that, but I was totally enchanted by her and by the little cemetery, and it began to spread over the whole book in a way. And Taylor has done a marvelous interpretation of her, and she's been allowed to have a lot more influence in the musical than I gave her in the book.
And that was kind of my question for you, is, you know, when you saw a character like Minerva in the book, how did you want to take her and expand her, and, you know, why did you see her as important?
Well, Savannah is really spiritual. I think it has something to do with the Spanish moss. So that goes back to your question about environment. So we have lots of the scenic design is Spanish moss hovering over everything. There's something about the shadows of that and just the beauty of it, but nature is hovering over you all the time instead of just at your feet. And so there's something about the natural world brings its own spirituality with it. And so Minerva, to me, is our connection to that in a if I'm shrinking the story from a book to a 2-hour musical, then I want to anchor it in some of the details of what Savannah is that are about the feeling that you have. And so that's part of it. There's so many other aspects to why she's important to what we're doing. The land is full of a lot of history, and she's someone who speaks with the dead. So, and then of course, everyone in the book except for John is deceased at this point, right? And so, so every character on the stage is deceased. So in some ways, it is like a Spoon River anthology in a way that, like, they're all coming from the cemetery. We start in the cemetery, and they're all coming up out of the cemetery to help us into the story. So she's the person that can take us on the boat, you know.
Well, and I think to some extent you brought up people don't sing, but, you know, when you bring magic into something, inevitably it makes it easier to rationalize people singing.
Yes, and spirituality too,
right?
Because people sing in their spiritual practice, so that's not absurd. So there's a reason again why, and they sing at parties. So then again, there's a reason why the book sings. They sing at clubs. They go to clubs all the time. So there's a reason why the book wants to be a musical in a lot of ways. And also it was interesting to me to figure out how to treat voodoo as a spiritual practice as opposed to a gimmick or like something weird. So that's what we work pretty hard to just say. These are people who have just a religious practice, just like Christianity. And so what is her religious practice and how can we bring that into the room, you know? I wanted her to be a leader in the story without forcing her to be a mentor, because that's also something that ends up happening a lot in the musical theater or the American theater, is a character like her would end up being a mentor
right.
And teach everybody the proper way to be in the world, and that's not what we wanted to do.
Okay, that's fascinating. Moving on, there's kind of two characters that I still want to talk about, and they have an overlap because of the structure of the play. You've brought up the notion that one of the characters is you. And I'm kind of curious, from writing the book's point of view, how did you approach thinking about yourself as a character or yourself as an individual?
First bit of writing I did while I was working on this book was a 47-page chapter on Joe Odom, who was a piano player, a lawyer, and a club owner, and charming beyond belief. It really was a very, very lovely guy. Everybody was crazy about him. And people came to his house and all that. So I wrote a chapter about him. And I wasn't satisfied with it. It was in the third person. So I did three exercises. Short narratives about people I saw on the street. And they're in the book in the beginning. Like half a page or whatever. And they worked. They were seen from my point of view, so it was first person. And that informed me that you better do the first person story, because it'll be much more real and alive. And so that's what I did. I did not want to be part of the action. So I wasn't part of the action, except when I'm being spoken to, and one or two other times. There's a scene in the Black Debutante Ball where I am very visible, but I'm not the main actor in it. However, I felt as though I was the character for that chapter. It's kind of funny chapter. If you read the book or see the musical, you'll know what I'm talking about. The idea that I was a person, I really didn't want to say anything about myself. It wasn't about me. And now there are 850 authors in the audience every night, because Taylor has turned the audience into the author. And the characters all talk to the audience as if they were talking to the author. If you're going to write a book about Savannah, you better know this or that. So I'm 800. 800 people are playing me in a musical.
That's a lot of fun. And was that kind of your notion of how to approach the first-person narrator?
Yeah, I felt like, because John doesn't tell us that much about himself in the book, that what we could do is we could insert ourselves into his experience. So we were John while we're reading the book. Everyone's talking to us. That's what it felt like in my experience of reading the book. And so we wanted to be the person who flies down to Savannah and meets all these people and is witness to all of this world. So I just thought that would be how do you do that on a stage? And so so it just made the audience the author.
A great way of approaching that character. And then
it was better than, for me, it was better than creating a narrator or an author, a character that shows up. Then I have to decide who that character is. Then I have to either decide if I'm putting John Barron in the musical and we're following him around, or I'm doing what the movie did, was make him, you know, John Cusack, and
yep.
You know what I mean. So then it's like, and I felt like that would be us. We would be removed from the experience by one person. So then we have to like make the narrator the central character, and that wasn't exciting to me. So yeah. I went a different way.
Because Clint Eastwood went back and forth: should there be a narrator, or should there not be a narrator? He put a narrator finally in, and then gave the narrator more of a story. Because he meets this girl in Savannah. So I did not want to get into the story to that extent, to any extent at all. So I'm just a listener. I converse, that's it.
Yeah. So I kind of held back then on the character that I think, you know, many people who read the book, myself included, are, you know, enraptured by or taken in by the Lady Chablis. And so I'm very curious about, you know, your initial meetings with her and how she fit into the story. And then, you know, the fact that then, as you mentioned, the movie, you know, she was able to star as herself and make herself that person. Tell us about meeting her and about what it was like and why it was important.
It was pretty much what I have in the book, describing how she would go and get her hormonal shots at the office of Dr. Myra Pope, who had her office in the building I was living in. So it happens just the way I said. I was parking my car, just as I said, and she was watching me because I was not a good parker. And she was laughing and with hands on her hips. And it started like that, the conversation in the car. Then I began to ask people about her. You know, they knew who she was. Not widely in Savannah, but the gay people knew. So that's how it started. And in fact, one other time, much later, I was driving her from one place to another. And we pulled up in front of the club she was working in, because she had to go in and do her thing. And I had trouble parking again. She said, "This is embarrassing. I'm getting out." She got out of the car. I still don't know how to drive.
New Yorker.
Yeah. You were asking about her about that.
Yeah.
She had a unique sense of humor. She was fast. And she kept doing things that were new to me. In fact, after the book was published, she did a few more outrageous things on stage that I hadn't seen her do before. I won't tell you what they are. But she was endlessly funny and fun. And I hope that the book transmits that to the reader. And it certainly, because she's my favorite character, I was insisting that the producers make sure that she become much more prominent in the musical, and perhaps the star of the musical, which in fact she is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm delighted about it. And the actor playing her is perfection.
Yeah.
Jay Harrison G. And I think she will become a favorite in New York when it gets to New York, and the critics will love her. And the audiences will love her. This is what I wanted. I loved her.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, she's no longer around.
Yeah, it was very clear from the book how wonderful a character she was. Now, Taylor kind of brought this up. Obviously, in 1994, when this came out, to have a trans woman central character who's so important, who's so positively wonderful, and presented in that light, was there pushback at all?
Not a bit.
Not a bit?
Not a bit. Also, I didn't think I was doing something unusual. I had no idea. When people said this is the first time a transgender woman has been a prominent character, I was surprised. I hadn't thought that it was groundbreaking in any way. It was this wonderful character. She happens to be a drag queen. That's the way I thought of her. And transsexual was not a word that people used in those days. So I didn't change a novel form or characters in a novel. The public changed its view of drag queens and people whose sexuality is shifting, and they changed it and all that. So it's the public who's changed since I started writing that book. Yeah. She was always, to me, and it's not nice to say drag queen, but that's what she was thought of then. Mm-hmm. Now she's transsexual. Fine. But I had no idea that I was doing anything unusual.
Right.
But apparently I was.
And you've already brought up that Lady Chablis makes a huge part of the show.
Yes,
and
she
and
does.
Is more or less the star. Did you ever get a chance to meet her?
I never did. No. Oh, okay. Yeah, but so, I feel like I did in many ways because of the book. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then,
but you know, I've worked with lots of people who knew her. I was in the club scene, you know, of New York City, and like Lady Bunny was, you know, knew her, and I know Lady Bunny, and you know, so, all those Atlanta girls came up to New York, and so there's a lot of back and forth.
Mm-hmm. And so, talk to me about adapting that character for the stage, and what makes it so important to the show.
Well, she sings. She sings. Mm-hmm. Just everything but she says sings. Everything,
that's the only difference. Of course, she was lip syncing in the show. In this, but
she
to have her
literally
sing. Well, the songs are wonderful. She sings it. She's a great job. But it doesn't matter. I mean, she was lip syncing, and this isn't that boring. But what she does, singing her own song, is well worth.
Yeah. I think that's the main reason, but it's also that I fell in love. I fell in love with her, and again, you know, I wasn't doing club work when I first. I wasn't a club kid when I first moved to New York, but shortly after that, I started doing drag in the club scene and making my theater in the clubs, and then brought the kind of club world into the theater world, and so. It's through this process I've realized, I probably wouldn't have done that had it not been for Midnight in the Garden. So I just feel very connected to her. And I think she's the future. Even though she's deceased, I think she's the future. So, and I wanted to write a story that wasn't just the past, but was also the future.
Yeah. I kind of wanted to talk, and I think that Lady Chablis is... that character that, as you're saying, is the future. We're in a time when there's been a lot of negative pushback for people who work in the drag field, for transgender. And so, you know, how important do you feel that this work is in trying to address that?
I mean, for me, that's not what it's about. If we inch the needle... Yeah, so, you know, if we dream the culture forward with it a little bit, then great. But I'm really just chasing my muse, you know, and everyone having read the book will have their version of what they want an adaptation to be, you know, because everyone's, again, chasing their taste. And this is my taste. This is the taste that I have. And so this is the version I wanted to do. And yeah, so I mean, why don't you want to sit and watch Jay Harrison G channel The Lady Chablis? That's what I want to do with my day. So.
And I think it's wonderful. And I think it, you know, from everything I've read, people are just in love with this, you know, with her and everything that she's
doing.
But
also, I will say that it's not just her story. There's two protagonists in this story. Both are queer people.
Yeah.
Jim Williams and the Lady Chablis. And we're telling two, it's almost like we've written two one-act musicals. But what we've done is we've placed them side by side. We've intermingled them, rather. So that one story can inform the other story, inform the other story, inform the other story. In the same way that Neighbors... you may not know what's going on with your neighbor, but what they do in that butterfly effect thing, it affects you. and vice versa. And so that's that. In order to tell the story of Savannah, that's what we've done. But we've also told the story of two queer people who are oppressed by the culture that they're growing up with and are trying to find their way in the world, trying to find a home for themselves in the world. And one of them uses the tools that they were oppressed by in order to oppress other people and manipulate and take charge of their world. And one of them chooses a different way. And so that's what we're doing. We're putting those side by side so that you can see that being at midnight, a garden of good and evil, you can see both of those things at the same time, and you can make the choices that you want to make in life. You know. So in some ways, musicals are always a morality tale, as much as we try for them not to be. You know, mm-hmm. they almost always are. And so this is a morality tale in a way that the book isn't. You know, book is allowed to be. Complicated in that way, but musicals are always—they're almost always saying these are our choices in life.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's been 30 years since the book. It's been 40 years since the actual start of the story of Jim and Dennis. And I'm kind of curious of what do you see? You know, you have an afterword in the new edition of the book. Talk to us a little bit about how you think the world has shifted in Savannah.
Savannah is much changed, partly because of the spotlight that's been shined on it, and people go there in huge numbers. So in the city, fortunately, the historic district is still the way it always was, and that's where my book takes place, basically. But it's surrounded by a modern city with not skyscrapers, they're going to be skyscrapers. It's much faster pace. But I also have to say that other small cities, are experiencing the same boom times as Savannah for different reasons. In Savannah, the people who go there want to know all about where each character lived and all that sort of thing. But so I don't feel guilty that I've ruined Savannah that I love. I mean, there's a possibility that I wondered whether I had. And I've been there recently, and I don't like a lot of things I see, but they don't impinge on the Savannah, the core of Savannah that I basically wrote about. And the club scene, I don't know what's happened to it, but I think the city is as much the way it used to be as is possible in these changing times.
Yeah.
Norfolk, Virginia has probably changed a lot too in different ways. I mean, with computers and phones and...
They're not as isolated. They're not as much a hothouse garden as they used to be.
That's right. Right. Very good. Well put, yes.
Well, they didn't have social media to gossip on.
That's absolutely.
And gossip, as you said, was the lifeblood of the town.
Yes.
Well, I appreciate you two talking to me about this. If you're open to it, I thought we could take 10 minutes and let the audience ask a few questions.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm going to take this microphone and see if anybody in the room would like to ask a question. Got one over here.
First, I'd like to thank both gentlemen for coming out and doing this. It's been fascinating. For John, I'd like to ask a question that focuses in on the publishing world. It's changed tremendously in the past, since the early 90s. Now there's the Big Five. What was it like for you? Was it easy or difficult to get a literary agent and to sell the book at that particular time? Can you share with us the process you went through in terms of getting this book published back in the early 90s? And thank you.
Okay. In the years I was an editor at Esquire, I dealt with literary agents because I was buying articles from various writers, and so I knew agents. And I wanted to do some writing before Midnight, did some writing and pieces, and I went to a friend of mine who was the top literary agent in New York, and she said, "Well, fine, I'm delighted to represent you," and she did on a few articles that I wrote. But then I was writing Midnight. It took me years, but I called to tell her that I was writing a book based on Savannah. And she said, "That was wonderful. Savannah's a great city, and all of that." And so I took forever, because I'm a very slow writer. Very, very slow. And I showed her about three chapters at first. And they were just three independent chapters, and she loved them. And she said, you'll be probably tying these together in some way. She didn't know quite what I was going to do with them. So then I finished writing it. It was about 7 years or even more. And I sent her the finished manuscript. And I waited a while, a little more time, and she sent it back. She said, oh, I so enjoyed reading this, but it's too local. So my agent turned down the book you are now reading. Her name, I've kept it all secret who she was, is Lynn Nesbitt. She has every other big name in New York. And she remains a friend of mine, mainly because I haven't told until now who it was. So what I did was I called another person, another agent I knew, and she asked me one question. She said, is this an exclusive submission? In other words, you're sending it to 10 agents or just me? I said, no one else has it now, which is true. And she read it and absolutely loved it. And her name is Suzanne Gluck, and if you have her as a literary agent, you are lucky. She's great. She sent it to five publishers, the five leading publishers, and they all said they wanted it. And so there was an auction among them, and one of them had said, we love the book, and we'd love to buy it if John Berendt would make one change. He didn't say what that change was, but she said, that's it, you don't get it. Because she was so attached to the book. She didn't want any publisher mucking with it. It was finally sold to Random House. And they didn't change it. They really left it the way it was. That's not a typical experience in publishing, I have to say. So don't really be guided by that, but there were horror stories. I didn't have a horror story.
Another question?
Yeah, my question is specifically for Taylor. I know that a lot of your work has dealt with camp and Commedia dell'arte and stuff, and I was just wondering if in adapting something like this for stage, if that was something you felt it was easy to lean into or something that maybe you felt like you had to hold back off a little bit.
You know, content dictates the form for me, so I'm always thinking about what the piece is about, and so then that dictates genre, style, form, craft that you use. And it was a city, it's eclectic, so I wanted it to have an eclectic, much like the music is very eclectic in our musical, I wanted the style of the scenes to be also have their own eclecticism. I thought about what would Chablis like in culture, and so how would she respond to a scene? So her scenes become a little bit more like the sitcoms of the time, you know. So they're allowing for a little bit more of that humor, but also she was a club performer. There's a very specific way that we talk in the clubs. There's a very specific way that I've written work in the clubs or written work for the theater that has that club energy to it. And so I included that for her scenes. If you see the musical, there's a bit at the very end that's very much something I've done on stage many times. So adding some of my life experience into it, stuff that I thought she would enjoy. And then for Jim's scenes, they require a slightly different kind of craft. And then for the scenes with Emma, who's a kind of a hybrid invented character, you know, she's a little bit of our white supremacist in the show. And there was a lot of thought about this humor, this irreverent humor of Savannah and how they kind of, they get away with their ideas about the world by being ironic and funny and irreverent. And so we thought about her as a clown a lot of the time, you know, how can we make her a bit of a clown to kind of show that. So it's all different, there's different techniques and styles and genres squished in it.
I think we have time for one or two more. I'll take this one.
Thank you both for up close and personal. This is for Taylor. After Chicago and The Goodman, will this be heading to New York, either off-Broadway or Broadway?
That is our hope. That's our hope, yeah. That was what we started with. Chicago has been a wonderful place for a lot of musicals to come and experiment and play. And I think the audiences here are trained for that, are used to it, appreciate it, like it, in a way that a lot of other places wouldn't, you know, might resent that. And instead, it's a special thing here in Chicago. So, yeah, we came here to work with the audiences here to make it, to make the musical that we want it to be. So it's a step. And I really don't think a musical or any play becomes its full self until it's had about 3 productions. So, yeah, we'll be going on to the next one.
I wondered if the plot in previews, has it changed? We're hearing gossip locally that the ending is going to change,
I think the first 5 previews didn't have the ending that we have right now. So maybe the first week didn't, maybe. I can't remember when we put it in, but we had an ending that nobody was, it was fine, but nobody, it wasn't magic. And I wanted magic, and everybody else wanted magic, so we've put a new ending in.
And that would be a reminder that the show has been extended into August, and if you went to the first 5, you need to buy tickets to go again.
John, when did it occur to you that the Midnight could be adapted to film or the screen? Was it while you're writing it? Did a friend say to you, hey, this could make for a good movie? At what point did that idea come to you?
Well, as I was writing as if all these characters were on a stage, and you have to get them on stage and off. And that has to be worked out in people's minds. So I imagine people saw this as real individuals in the setting they were in, i.e. a stage, whatever, a room, outdoors, whatever. And so that's the way I wrote it, in the style of a stage play or a movie. But I had no idea that this would ever make a movie, and much less a musical. Didn't have it in my mind at all. People always ask me, do you think your book's going to be a movie? I said, let me do the book first.
Yeah.
So that's, eventually it's going to be an ice show, I'm sure.
Okay, one more question.
So the one character I haven't heard you mention was part of the storyline has to do with the debutante. And I'd like to hear something about that because, for my money, she has the best song in the show.
Yeah, Lavella is a pretty minor character in the book, but when we decided that we were going to have 2 protagonists, which is very unusual in a musical, you usually just have 1 protagonist, but we decided for very specific reasons that we'd have 2, then they each needed their own antagonists, you know? And so Jim obviously has Emma, and Chablis had Lavella, and so we pumped up Lavella's part so that Chablis would have something that she was fighting against besides society, you know, and besides the type of person like Bert, the club owner, who's, you know, racist to her and stuff. But that's something we've seen a lot of, and so I thought on a stage it would be interesting to see how she transforms an antagonist instead of perpetuates the antagonism, because that was really her spirit. And so we pumped up Lavelle a little bit, yeah.
Well, and with that, I think we could go on all afternoon, but I know you have things to do. So I want to first thank John Taylor. Thank you both for being here. Can we give him a round of applause?
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.